too?
Yeah.
Good. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
The genesis for this talk began about 5 weeks ago when I went to Doka-san with Kate. And I was saying to Kate that I really wanted to give my spiritual practice everything. And she said, you know, I've been meaning to schedule you for a Dharma talk. And I immediately thought, everything but that. And that seems to me what commitment is about. A commitment is about doing the thing that actually you have a lot of resistance to. And I thought, well, if I'm going to spend the next however many weeks in my habitual response of anxiety and obsession about what it is that I'm going to talk about, I'm going to pick a subject that I really want to immerse myself in. And I had just recently been given this book. It's the Book of Joy. And it is, it's very recently published, and it comes out of a week-long meeting between the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, where they came together to discuss the subject of joy in order to put out a teaching to the world. This should be on humanity's book list. So what I'm doing today really is more of an extensive book review than really all that original from me. I think when people first encounter Buddhism, it can often seem quite pessimistic because of the emphasis on suffering and because of the focus on mortality. And if you look around the room, the dark clothing, the silence, the forms can all seem a bit doom and gloom. And I believe that suffering is put at the forefront. It's actually the first of the noble truths, the law of suffering, that suffering is part of our human experience, or part of experience, is because suffering really draws our attention. When things are going well, when they're going right, we tend to not notice that very much. You know, it's as Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, the non-toothache. But suffering is a great deal harder to just ignore. I think the focus on mortality has to do with reinforcing the notion that there isn't endless time. Don't waste time. It's the end of one of the sutras. But suffering is not meant to be an end. It's meant to be what brings up attention, what brings up consciousness. Because Buddhism then goes on to talk about the end of suffering. And in particular, I wanted the Brahma-Biharas, which are the heavenly realms. And the Brahma-Biharas are loving-kindness, or metta, compassion, or karuna, sympathetic joy, which is mudita, and equanimity, which is upekkha. So sympathetic joy is the one that I want to focus on today. And sympathetic joy is, it's not just joy for oneself and from oneself. It is joy that is available in the world. That it doesn't, joy does not have to be a personal sort of quality or possession. That wherever joy exists, it's available to all of us. And that's because really the basis of suffering is separation. And the basis of joy, or the heavenly realms, is the fact of that everything is one. It's united. So if everything is one, then obviously the joy that is experienced out in the world is actually really being experienced by me as well. Well, what are some of the ways that suffering can be transformed? What are the things that actually are blocking our ability to be joyful? One of them is that we live in a very materialistic, very individualistic culture, which reinforces over and over again our sense of separation. There's a lot of talk nowadays about happiness. Happiness comes up all the time. Happiness can actually also be a sort of conditional feeling. Happiness often can be sort of based on sort of really having what you want in life, which then makes it subject to when you don't want what you have in life, you can feel very unhappy. But life, of course, has a mixture and always will have a mixture. And the thing about the Brahma Viharas, they're called immeasurable because they're boundless. They have nothing whatsoever to do with our creating these states. These are universal, boundless states that we merely have to remove the obstacles to our actually experiencing these states. I once read a line that said, "Seek not love. Love is an eternal state. Rather, seek to know the ways that you're obstructing love." Well, I think you could say exactly the same thing for joy. You don't seek joy. You seek to remove the obstacles to what is there all the time. And if you look around the world, can there be any doubt? The beauty that is, I remember going for a walk just after I decided I was going to do this talk on joy, and going for a walk in this garden, and I thought, the variety, the complete abundance and beauty that is present. Why is all that there? It's not necessary for the reproduction of the plant. We could have one color, you know. But nature is abundant with this energy. One of the things that really does get in the way is our emotions. So our emotions, okay, so fear. Fear is a survival. Fear and the attendant behavior of flight is basic to our survival. It's hardwired into virtually all beings. It has a very practical purpose, but the problem with it is that we often get habituated to it, so that rather than it being a response to a situation that calls for that fear, we incorporate that fear and it covers a much larger area. We start off being frightened of mice, and pretty soon we're frightened of rodents, and pretty soon we're frightened of going anywhere that we might encounter that fear, and it tends to grow if we don't actually try and work against it. Or not work against it, try and work with it. The antidote to fear is courage. And courage comes from the French word cœur, which means heart. And so courage is not a matter of defeating fear. It's a matter of bringing our heart to fear, of having the courage to just be with that fear. And like all suffering, it can be an opening. It can show you the path, the way to open up yourself. Frustration, anger. This is another one of the big, and its attendant behavior, which is fight or aversion, you might call frustration and anger. Frustration and anger usually comes out of a defensive feeling of being threatened, that there's something that you want or need, you feel is necessary for your survival or your well-being, and in some way that is being threatened. Sometimes you're not even conscious of what it is that you're threatened by. The antidote to anger is actually to explore your vulnerability, to open yourself up to what it is that you're threatened by, and to actually share that. And in that way, your vulnerability can actually become your strength. Sadness, despair. This is the turning in on yourself. Sadness, despair, grief, these are emotions that last a lot longer, usually, than fear and anger. And once again, they've actually found, they've done studies, and they found that people who feel sad are often quite empathetic, because they feel that quality of sadness in others. And so the sadness, the thing about sadness is to use that energy rather than using it against yourself, but using it as a link, because all people experience these emotions, and lots don't know how to work with them. So they either turn against themselves or they turn against someone else. So sadness can be a way that you link with others. So, the ultimate source of all suffering is, as I said, this sense of separation from ourselves and each other and from our world. I think Buddhism's greatest gift to the world is this sense of unity. In this book, they talk about the eight pillars of joy, and that's really what I want to go into. The first four of these pillars are thought to be are pillars of the mind. It's how our mind approaches the world. And the last four are of the heart. It's actually easier to work with the mind than with emotions, with thoughts than with feelings. So, because you can be somewhat deliberate about it. So the first one is perception. Have you ever noticed that when things are not going the way you want in life, how the world seems to implode upon itself? It seems to get narrower and narrower until it's just down to this little point of pain inside yourself. Well, perception is the ability to open it up. Open up to a larger sphere, to how this is happening. Whatever you're experiencing is something that's experienced by others. And you can work on your perception quite deliberately. you can, you know, there's many, many sayings that go like, put yourself in another person's shoes. Empathy. Deliberately try and think of, okay, so what's going on for this other person? Even this other person that is perhaps causing me all this grief right now. Why do you think that maybe they're acting the way they're acting? Look at it from a completely different angle. I sometimes try and imagine, I have a little Yorkshire Terrier, and I try and sometimes imagine, okay, now what is life like for my dog? In some ways, that gets me out of the rut of really projecting myself onto another person. And I actually started writing haiku poems about how my dog was experiencing the world. And so let go of the outcomes. Let go of goals. Let go of the let go of feeling like you have to know or things have to turn out a certain way. The difficulty with doing that is that it really stops you from experiencing what's happening now while you're busy trying to project out into what should happen or what you want to happen or what you fear happens. You know, try and be with the process. Drop the goals, the expectations. I had a very good friend who was a person that I really associated joy with, and she once said, anything worth doing is worth doing badly. And I thought, well, that's really true. Because if it's worth doing, it's worth doing, whatever way you can do it, you know? And if badly is all you can do, well, then you do it badly. But this whole idea of don't set up a standard for yourself. Just do the best you can and let life unfold as it will. Perspective. Well, Viktor Frankl was a Jewish man who went through Auschwitz. And he said, our perspective towards life is our final and ultimate freedom. You do have the choice how you want to see things. The next pillar is humility. We all come from cosmic dust. Everything that's in this universe is really just the composite elements that have been created in the Big Bang. And we at the same time all contain shards of the divine. So we link with all humanity, all beings. The sense of arrogance, I think, that sometimes is one of the default positions of our humanity is really ignorance in disguise. It's because you haven't taken a big enough perspective. If you think you're really grand, you just have got looking at a very small part of the picture. So you can let go of the need to feel like you somehow have to do something that is extra special. You're part of humanity. We all get to do our bit. We're all essential, but we're all just tiny fragments of the cosmos. Humor. Humor is a particular favorite. Oh, I should say, humility. The word comes from the Latin word for humus, which is soil. As does humor. The root word is also humus, which is soil. And humility actually leads to humor, because taking yourself seriously is usually about putting yourself on a pedestal. Humor is the great equalizing, you know, it's grounded. And it's interesting, in the medieval courts, the only person that could speak the truth to the king was the jester, because he was not a threat to the king's power. So the jester was given the power to speak the truth. I've been watching a lot of Netflix humors, comedy shows, and I'm really interested to see how most of the comedians, at least the ones that I've seen, they come from backgrounds where they have either ethnic minorities, or they've undergone great hardships, or they have they've been persecuted, and they turn that in to a way of talking about the world, of showing, you know, of showing how of how power often takes this position of being above everything. Humor takes the position of, no, you're just like everybody else, you know? My husband uses jokes a lot, and he's Jewish, and Jewish people, well, there's a lot of Jewish people, including Norman Fisher, who use humor. And we had my son and my daughter-in-law and grandchild visiting, and Harold started telling these lame, old, silly jokes, and I'm sort of cringing inside. I'm going, oh no, we're not going to do this again. But I noticed how everybody was laughing, and everybody else was telling silly, lame jokes, and how it really it really relaxed and equalized everybody out. So I want to tell one quick joke. So it was an ecumenical conference, and these three participants got together for some gambling, for a friendly game of gambling at the end of it. And gambling was illegal in this state. And they were caught, and they came in, and there was money on the table. And so they were taken before the judge. And there was a Jesuit priest, there was a Baptist minister, and there was a rabbi. And so the judge said, well, he said, I know you're all men of your word, so I'm just going to ask you whether you were gambling. So he started with the Jesuit priest, and he said, Father, were you gambling? And the Jesuit priest said, in a universe where God controls everything and knows everything, is there really any such thing as gambling? So the judge says, okay, I take your point, case dismissed. And then he comes to the Baptist minister, and he said, well, Father, or minister, were you gambling? And the minister said, well, I have a confession to make. He said, in my previous life, I was a gambler, and I was a very good one. He said, now I've changed my ways, and I'm in a very poor parish. And he said, against these men, I wasn't gambling, I was fundraising. And so he said, fine, case dismissed. So then he came to the rabbi, and he said, well, rabbi, were you gambling? The rabbi looked around, and he said, with whom?
You sure he wasn't a Zen guy?
I know, I wanted to make it a Zen guy, actually, but I wasn't sure how I would title him. Anyways, so with humor, acceptance. This is the only place where change can begin, is with acceptance. The ability to accept our life as it is, with the beauty and pain, is the gift of equanimity. Things are as they are. And while that can often feel not the way you want it to be, not the way that feels just. But nevertheless, they are as they are. And often the hardest place to accept is acceptance about yourself. That you could be better, you should do this, you know, all the shoulds and coulds and woulds in our mind. And all of those actually stop us from knowing ourselves. Because while we hold up all of these expectations, we're not really able to just be with ourselves. We're not really able to be just with the world. Peace and equanimity come from the letting go of goals and methods. When we're actually able to accept the present as it is, that allows us to forgive the past for how it's been. And that moves on now to the four pillars of the heart with forgiveness. Forgiveness is what's said is what brings you into the present. As long as you're caught in not forgiving, then you're really caught in some past pain, some past suffering. Often people feel though that they don't want to forgive because that would let go of the injustice or the fact that something has been done that wasn't right. That, I think, is almost completely wrong. It's almost completely the opposite. Because while you are unable to forgive another or yourself, you're actually not able to see the situation very clearly. And so forgiveness does not mean forgetful. It means actually seeing it clearly and putting it in a bit of bigger perspective, accepting this is the humility and the humor that we talked about. Forgiveness can actually be a incredible opening too. I was reading, it was a true story about a woman whose family lived in Squamish, and the next door neighbors the parents were away, and there was a loud party going on, and so her husband went next door to see what was happening, and he was killed. He was murdered. There was a drunken crowd, and anyways, no one would come forward. No one would say they saw anything. Everybody closed up, and she left the community with her two young children, who were, of course, now fatherless. But she couldn't come to rest around this. She couldn't integrate it. She needed to know that somebody understood what they had done in her life, done to her life. And she wrote a letter to the newspaper, just to the Squamish paper, and put this out. And this was about a year and a half after it happened. And the person who had done it, who was a young man, who had also not been able to live with himself, but was terrified of the consequences of coming forward, he did come forward. And he confessed to the police. And he went to jail. She actually spoke on his defense when it actually did come to trial. Anyways, she still felt she needed to do something more. She needed to somehow use this experience that she had as a way of warning other young people about what can happen in a moment of inebriation or just disregard for what the future is. And so she started doing, she started going and doing talks at high schools and community centers, just talking about what had happened in her life. And then the man that had killed her husband wrote her a letter. He wrote her a letter of apology, of, you know, asking for her forgiveness. And so she started using that letter in her presentations. And then she actually went through a reconciliation process with this man that was in prison. And when he came out of prison, they started doing the talks together. And that sort of healing is the sort of, that's of course a very dramatic case, but there's actually cases all over the world. Desmond Tutu was the person who in South Africa began the Truth and Reconciliation process. That was the way that they went forward to heal their country, because if it's one person of the family against another, how do you go forward with that? How do you heal a nation where it's been one against the other? And they realized that the only way forward was to tell the truth and forgive the past. And in Canada, we're actually also just, well, we've sort of finished the Truth and Reconciliation process around what has happened with the Indigenous population here. But the work from it is really going on, and I think it's really waking us all up to what really was the reality, and how do we want to go into the future, and how do we incorporate the other into ourselves. Forgiveness opens you to gratitude, of being grateful for things just as they are, not because they are creating a certain blessing or good state that you want, but just gratefulness. Gratefulness for being alive. Gratefulness for being on this earth. Gratefulness for seeing what a beautiful world it is. Gratefulness, the next pillar is compassion. Compassion is an instinctual response. If all beings look after and care for their young, the compassion is gratitude that is extending out into the world in the form of relating to the other's suffering. Of course, compassion means to be with suffering, with the suffering of all. So this is the heart pouring forth now and connecting up with the other. And all the studies show that the fastest route, or the most predictable way of creating a sense of well-being in yourself is to do something for another. Not for yourself, but for another. So compassion is the gateway to joy, and in particular, sympathetic joy, which, as I mentioned, is that linking with not just our own experience, but with that of all beings. Which leads us to the final one, and I'm watching the time here. Generosity. Generosity connects us up and reinforces the knowledge of our interdependence. It is so basic to our nature that it's considered instinctual. The love of a mother for an offspring is a universal symbol. In the Heart Sutra, it says, even as a mother at risk of her own life watches out and protects her only child, so too, with a boundless mind, one should cherish all living things. Suffusing love over the entire world, above, below, and all around. So I'd like to just finish with a reading from this book. When we practice generosity of spirit, we are in many ways practicing all the other pillars of joy. In generosity, there is a wider perspective in which we see our connection to all others. There is a humility that recognizes our place in the world and acknowledges that at another time, we could be the one in need, whether that need is material, emotional, or spiritual. There is a sense of humor and an ability to laugh at ourselves so that we do not take ourselves too seriously. There is acceptance of life, in which we do not force life to be other than what it is. There is forgiveness of others and a release of what might otherwise have been. There is gratitude for all that we have been given. Finally, we see others with a deep compassion and a desire to help those who are in need. And from this comes a generosity that is a wise selfishness, a generosity that recognizes that helping others as helping ourselves.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to end them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
So if you just put your seats back and stand at your seat, someone do three bows.
Did you turn that off? Did you push this?
Yes, when I started it.
Not to end yet?
I didn't end.